fantasía.
This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory on the University of British Columbia campus. Hello and welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and we're here today with Ira Israel. He is the author of How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult, A Path to Authenticity and Awakening. Ira is a licensed marriage and family therapist, a professional clinical counselor, and he graduated from the University of Pennsylvania with degrees in psychology, philosophy, and religious studies. And he has a DVD series, A Beginner's Guide to Happiness, as well as Mindfulness for Depression. He also teaches at Esalen, and you can find him at iraisrael.com. Welcome to the show, Ira.
Thank you, Marie. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for being with us. So I have so many questions for you, but coming up, the holidays are just around the corner. So I feel like the idea of childhood being recreated now that we're adults is just on the surface, because we're all going to be forced to spend time with people that we don't always see through the rest of the year. So I'm wondering if you want to share a little bit about the book. Let's start with that. Tell us a little bit about the book.
Sure. I believe as sentient beings that primarily we want to be loved unconditionally. And we grew up in this hyper-competitive culture, which only gave us tools to gain love conditionally. And this is all part of the individuation process that occurs from when babies are from 6 months old to 18 months old. So a lot of these ideas, and even to go into your talk about the holidays, these triggers are subconscious. And, I'll lead into that with a very famous Ram Dass quote. If you ever think you're enlightened, go spend the weekend with your family. So what happens is, in a baby's mind, when you hold a baby up to a mirror in the early days of its life, its eyes dart around because it has no self. It can't recognize that those are my eyes. So what occurs is the individuation process, where a baby gains a sense of self from 6 to 18 months. So that time, the thesis of the book is, we become what we love and we become what we hate, and both are inauthentic, meaning that whatever attributes that our primary caregivers had, we imitate because we want them to accept us, to approve us, to like us. And then in the individuation process, we also do the exact opposite. More specifically, the example of individuation in the book is, like when teenagers get tattoos, they're saying, this is my body. Like, you can't tell me what to do with it. So, there's the individuation process and how we become, how we gain agency as adults and how we become financially independent and emotionally independent and psychologically independent. It's a process. So what I'm looking at is, what are the ramifications of that process, the way we individuate babies and children in our culture? And I think that there are a lot of psychological ramifications to growing up within this system, which is buttressed by capitalism, science, and religion. And we need, instead of thinking that there's some sort of rogue gene for depression that causes 23 million Americans to take antidepressants every day, we should look at the foundation of our society.
All right. Thank you. And so you say that our society is buttressed on all of these things, the consumerism and science and all that. So what ideally should it be held up by?
There is no shoulds. I'm just examining what is, and that is, we have these systems. If you try to explain to a feudal lord 500 years ago that someday his economic system would not be there and there would be this thing called capitalism, and you would go, walk to the factory and get money for the time you spent, milling these objects, he wouldn't have believed you. So we can't see what the next society or the next economy or the next civilization is going to be. But I definitely think, and maybe you disagree with me, that the society that we've created right now is unsustainable, particularly like our government has borrowed $20 trillion. And we're going to go further into debt after this new tax reform bill is passed. And, you know, you and I are the beneficiaries of all this debt, be it through mortgages, student loans and credit cards. So, you know, that is essentially, to me, unsustainable. It's not infinite. The rest of the world is not going to keep Americans living so high on the hog indefinitely.
Well, thankfully, I live here in Canada, but we do have a lot of debt as well. We call it the deficit.
Uh-huh.
Yes, we do have a deficit here in Canada as well. But we spend a little more of it on social programs, I think, than military.
That's right.
But so why exactly did you write and title your book, How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult?
Well, I use humor to raise consciousness. Wittgenstein famously said that the history of philosophy could be recounted as a series of jokes. And I'm actually interested in how jokes work. Because you know, you have these setups, and then your mind, once you hear the setup, has an expectation, and then the joke goes in another direction. So the beginning of the book, the first six chapters, basically deconstruct authenticity and all the things that people believe that it is today. You know, when people say things like, I'm quitting my stock market job to become a yoga teacher, I'm just being authentic. Or I'm leaving this relationship because of this reason or that reason, I'm just being authentic. So, you know, that is one version of authenticity. But what I'm looking at is, how do we understand this concept psychologically and colloquially and philosophically and, you know, those notions. That's why I wrote the book.
All right. Thank you, Ira. So it sounds like you're not saying that there is one definition of authenticity.
There's definitely not. And that's why I subtitled the book A Path to Authenticity and Awakening. I really dislike, there's a bunch of people in my community who say that they have the path, as if there's only one path. And I'm doing the exact opposite. I'm saying there's 7 billion people, there's 7 billion meditation methods. You know, everybody has to find their own set of tools that works for them. So I'm not proselytizing. I'm just telling people the 5 things that I think authenticity is comprised of, and that is attachment, atonement, attunement, presence, and congruence.
Ooh, I like it.
Do you want me to break those down?
Sure, we will do that in just a moment.
Is Koko Hamamatsu talking about koi fish in a pond or the youth at CITR and Discorder? Get info on your wares, services, or events directly to students, musicians, artists, and all the coolest cats from Bellingham to Squamish by advertising with CITR and Discorder on air, in print, or online. This can be your reality if you email us at advertising@citr.ca or call 604-822-4342. Visit CITR.ca for rates and packages.
Oh, Koko-san, konnichiwa.
We are speaking right now with Ira Israel. He is the author of How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult, A Pathway to Authenticity and Awakening, not the pathway. All right, go ahead, Ira.
Sure. Attachment means being aware of our primary attachment dynamics. There's a beautiful quote by Harville Hendrix in a book called Marriage as the Path to Wholeness. And he says, the subconscious purpose of marriage in North America is to enable us to complete our childhoods. Our parents had deficits. Those deficits wounded us. Those wounds became defense mechanisms, and those defense mechanisms became our personalities. And we'll always be attracted to people who can replicate the dynamics from our primary caregivers. So what I find is, you know, there's a over 40% divorce rate in the United States, and a lot of the patterns that are developed or the patterns that we see in adults really can be traced back to the first 2 years of the child's life, whether they have learned that the world is an abundant, secure place and they can just lean in, or they have to lean out and avoid, or they'll suffer. So I think that one of the key components of authenticity is being aware of our primary attachment dynamics, how we interact with other people, whether it's our eye contact or whether we learn to be the sarcastic person and create some distance that way, but just to be aware of that. So the first component of authenticity is attachment. And then the second one is atonement or at-one-ment. So there's a beautiful quote by Suzuki Roshi, who says, you're perfect and there's room for improvement, meaning that there's a part of you that there's a oneness, that you're connected to source, to mystery, to whatever you believe in is your higher self, your higher power. And then for me, the things that need tweaking or improvement is usually those defense mechanisms. Winnicott says that we develop a false self in order to survive our childhoods. So what I'm interested in is that, Carl Jung called it a persona, or that facade that we built to try to get our emotional and psychological needs met when we were 8, 9, 10 years old. And, all those things worked. They're fantastic. But now that we're 45, 50, they could be actually hindering us from getting the authentic love that we want. So we have to clean up this way of being that was developed years ago. And the way to do that is forgiveness. So there's a beautiful quote by Lily Tomlin who says, forgiveness means giving up all hope of having a better past. And this is akin to what Tara Brach calls radical acceptance. You know, our mind is built to do these hypothetical retroactive things like, oh, well, if I went to this school, I'd be happy, or if I married this person, or if I had kids, or if I didn't have kids, or if I became a lawyer, if I didn't become a lawyer. And your mind does this thing, and it's causing your suffering, because really you can't change the past. There's no good complaining about anything that you can't change. You know, that is the cause of suffering or, resentment. So your only choice really is to accept every moment of your life, even the ones that were highly unpleasant. So then attachment, atonement, and then the third part is attunement, and that's being able to truly connect with other human beings. So the one thing that correlates strongly with happiness is our ability to connect to other people. And so I do all these exercises to get people to attune, with their facial affect and their eyes and be able to connect with other people. Some of the things I say in the book are mirror neurons do not fire via text message, meaning that we really need to break bread with people. We need them face to face. We can't, there's not, the thing that happens with mirror neurons doesn't take place with likes on Snapchat or Facebook or Instagram. It only takes place when you're sitting there eyeball to eyeball with another human being. And then the second quote from the book is one hug equals 1 million Facebook likes. You know, we delude ourselves into thinking that we're like taking part in humanity. And, we have this this epidemic of alienation and depression in our society. So we really need to know how to attune to other people and validate their emotional experience. There's another quote that I'll give by Harville Hendrix. He says, because I quoted in the book, he says, you only have one choice in this life. You can either be right or you can be in relationship. So, a lot of people, we were taught to always, think of a conversation like it's a legal debate in some ways, and that we have to like win. We have to prove that we're right. So I really enjoy working with couples in my private practice because I point to the door and I say, right and wrong is on the other side of that door. You can pick them up on the way out while we're in here. Anything goes, you can say anything, and the other person has to validate your emotional experience. And it gets very flavorful and rich once you eliminate the paradigm of, people trying to be right.
I have a question about attunement and connection, actually, because it just happened today. I was downtown on my way to return some things that I'd purchased, and I was on my phone. I had my head down and someone called out my name and I looked up and it was someone that I knew in person, but mostly I only ever see her on Facebook. And right away, because I had been in that smartphone mode, I wasn't in the mode of talking or knowing what to say or anything. And I was just kind of stunned for a minute, pulled out of this little bubble I was in. and I didn't know what to do. And I feel like that is common.
Yes, I actually would equate it with an addiction. And every tap on our screens, on our phones, on our smartphones is like, you know, a laboratory rat getting a little bit of cocaine. And we get a little dopamine burst every time, like, we're tapping on things and we get we see that red mark, or we see, like, somebody sent me a message or something like that. So I'm going to equate all these interactions like addictions. And, you know, yes, this woman who was coming towards you, she I would say she you know, woke you from your addiction. And that was very jarring. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it was. And it took me – I didn't quite know how to – adjust from that mode into
real life.
Yeah, it was, and it felt really awkward. The conversation felt really awkward, and I was like, "Oh, now I have to actually talk to a human being and make small talk," and it just felt super uncomfortable, which is kind of sad.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Do you have any tips? Because I know we're all out in the world, and
I would say you need to carve out time for human interaction. There's a book, America the Anxious, by Ruth Whitman, where she says that in America, the average person spends 4 minutes a day socializing.
Wow.
And so, yeah, we really need to relearn the art of conversation, not just, and you know, it's really funny to me because people come in my office and they start talking about full-on conversations that they had with their boyfriend, their girlfriends. And then finally, after like a half an hour, I'll be like, were you guys together or was this by text? And most of the young people will be like, oh, this was by text. And that's not, in my understanding of reality, that's not a conversation. I mean, I literally have specific rules for text messaging, and they are for making appointments, making meetings, and for emergencies, and then egregious flirting, you know, like, I miss you, like, I can't wait to see you. But they're not for conversations. I mean, most information is nonverbal, and it goes through, you know, facial expressions and the tone of someone's voice and their inflections and things like that. Text message, everything, it goes out the window, even sarcasm and irony. And there's so much room for misinterpretation. I think there's a much larger downside to trying to communicate anything by text message than any other way. I mean, I make a joke, it might be in the book, but it's elsewhere. In 500 years, people will look back on text messaging the way we look back on smoke signals.
Oh, totally. Lately, too, this has been happening where I've applied for jobs, and rather than picking up the phone and taking 2 minutes to schedule, they'll email with me, which I guess might be a time saver for them. But the thing is that if you pick up the phone and talk with someone, you get immediately, you hear the tone of their voice, you hear a certain vibe.
Yep.
You could actually save an entire interview, because if the phone is picked up and the vibe on the other end is, that's just saved you an hour of your time.
Yep. Yeah, we're living in a very, very strange time. I mean, we can go right into a conversation regarding like dating and Tinder and swiping right and swiping left, and then going through the little messaging thing, and then you move to the phone, and then finally you meet in person, and then you realize like you've just wasted like, you know, weeks of your life to get there, because we just don't, or the way we're interacting is, I honestly find it inhumane.
That's a good word for it, inhumane.
The AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the Helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the Helpline is one of the many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The Helpline number is 604-696-4666, or contact us at aidsvancouver.org.
Nikkei National Museum's Hastings Park 1942 exhibit marks the 75th anniversary of Japanese-Canadian internment. Visit the exhibit until January 13th to see Japanese Problem, a contemporary performance piece which offers a glimpse into a dark episode of history at the Pyrenees Livestock Barn. Nikkei National Museum is located in Burnaby, and entry is by donation.
Right now, we are speaking with Ira Israel. He is the author of How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult, A Path to Authenticity and Awakening. So we've covered, you've covered attachment, atonement, and attunement.
So there's only two left, and that's present and letting. See, the problem is that your mind assimilates anything that's traumatic by saying, wow, that was really humiliating, painful, disturbing. I'm never going to let that happen again. And so what it does is it takes all these traumas from your past and it projects them into your future. And what I'm advocating is to for us to learn presence. Ram Dass called it to learn how to be here now. In the present moment, you know, I don't need to worry about being hit by a car because I live pretty far from the sidewalk. So I shouldn't have to, you know, worry about those things. So our mind is basically, its primary job is to try to stave off future traumas. And it does that by creating prejudices, expectations, resentments, woulda, coulda, shoulda, didn'ts, things like that. And I'm saying that all those things make us inauthentic in some ways because we're showing up already listening, already hearing certain things when they might not actually be a part of the conversation. And this is a great time also after I go into the last part, congruence, to go back to what happens during the holidays, because, you know, those people who put the triggers in place when you were, you know, 6 months old or eight years old, like your older brother, your older sister, you go back to the holidays and they say, pass the salt. And all of a sudden you're screaming and crying and you know, you don't know why, but like they're the person who put whatever like you hear as, oh, I'm not good enough. I can never do anything right. And then the person was just sitting there like, I just said, pass the salt, please. You know, I didn't say you're a useless human being who will never add up to anything. I just said, pass the salt.
Oh, but there was a tone there, Ira.
Right. So we interpret all these things or misinterpret all these things. So getting back to presence, what I try or what I espouse personally is yoga and meditation, because yoga is just a moving meditation and it just gets us focused on the present moment for whatever amount of time we choose to practice. For me, I practice in the morning. I practice yoga or meditation. And it's just like getting that one clean breath, getting that anchor for the rest of the day, getting to some distance between the machinations that my mind is going through about things that I cannot change in the past and things that may or may not occur in the future. You know, we really need to learn how to be present. And then the fifth part of authenticity for me is congruence. And we live in this incredibly privileged world where we're not running from lions and tigers, and we get to decide who we want to be, what we want to look like, and what kind of lives we want to lead. And so what I'm advocating is personal integrity, to really sit down and decide who you want to be, and then be that person. There's a beautiful quote by André Gide. He says, "It is better to be hated for what you are than to be loved for what you are not." So that's the quote that starts the book. And I really think that sitting down and just writing out like who you want to be. And for me, I kind of project myself into the future. And I always think like, what do I want it to say on my tombstone? Do I want it to say he was right? Do I want it to say richest guy in the cemetery? Or do I want to say, you know, travel to St. Bart's? You know, no, like I think any sane person wants their tombstone to say beloved. You know, you don't want accomplishments on your tombstone. You want it to say loving father, loving mother, loving sister, loving brother. You don't want it to say all the things that are, stressing us out on a daily basis.
Thank you, Ira. With regards to this, the tombstone, it feels like it would be hard to get there because, yes, we have this vision of the person that we would like people to say that we are after we're gone. Mm-hmm. But we also have the reality of living in the day-to-day world, and it's so easy to get caught up in paying the mortgage and buying the next iPhone. So I guess presence is one of the things that has to do with it. But, you know, what other tips do you have to reel back so that we can look at the bigger picture?
Well, we have to realize that what we consider to be reactions mostly are maladaptive, meaning that if I'm driving on the freeway and someone goes across five lanes in front of me with no indicator signal, my reaction is to try to right that cosmic injustice by screaming obscenity because that's where I grew up. That's what you do. And that's maladaptive. A, it could get me shot. B, the person could be, you know, his pregnant wife could be in the back seat and they might have to get to the hospital or something bad's going to happen. So, you know, it's just cultivating an awareness of your natural reactions and then cultivating non-reactivity so that you can make healthy choices instead of, you know, coming out with anger or any other emotions that don't help you get your long-term needs met. And as I said, I really feel that as sentient beings, we yearn to be loved unconditionally, but unfortunately, we're only given tools in our society to gain love conditionally. The conditions are usually because we're sexy, we're smart, we're rich, we speak well. And eventually, what that foments is resentment, because we're constantly seducing people into liking our outer selves, and then we resent them for not loving the inner authentic selves, which we didn't show them. And so, you know, you expect your boyfriend or girlfriend or wife or husband to be psychic in some ways and to tune into, you know, what's under the surface, but then you're not happy when they don't live up to that task. And what I'm saying is, you know, learn authentic communications, to be vulnerable, you know, talk about your real emotional needs and try to connect with other people.
Hmm. So that brings up a question for me. Ira, do you think that it's possible or even effective to have those kind of conversations like today with the passing of the person that I saw and I felt forced to make small talk? Would that have been a better conversation if I hadn't tried to make small talk and instead been vulnerable?
For me, it's all about priorities. And, you know, it's a funny thing. When I go into a store, let's say, and the person working there is on the telephone, I mean, I was always taught that like an immediate someone face to face, like a real, you know, like person who might buy something is more important than someone on the telephone. So I guess that skews me because priorities for me are, you know, if someone is there sitting with you or standing with you, you know, you don't make them wait, whereas phones are secondary. I mean, as I said, I think there's a lot of room for miscommunication. I actually just had a very strange email experience with a meditation teacher about 5 minutes ago, because I called this person a week ago and for whatever reason, he didn't call back, but then returned an email and we ended up having to like cancel an event because the younger generation does not regard telephone calls the way my generation does, which I find really, really fascinating to me. Like he went back and forth five emails, and another person did this. They contacted me through LinkedIn, and it was fascinating to me. They said, are you open to working on some other projects? And I said, absolutely, call me on this number. And then she said, well, when's a good time to call? And I said, anytime after 1 o'clock. And then she wrote back again, how about 1:15? And by the time I looked back at my LinkedIn thing, it was already 5:30 and she hadn't called. And I'm just like, why do you need five emails to make one phone call okay? It's just a very different propriety or sense of propriety from my generation. I mean, if I want to talk to someone, I pick up the phone and I call them. I don't text them or email them and ask them permission to call. You call them. If they answer the phone, they answer the phone. If not, you call back later, you know? I don't know. I'm not understanding it at all.
Well, I bet when you were a kid too, people might just drop by the house.
Totally. And the funny thing is that, you know, when I was growing up, like the phone would ring and it was like a gift. It was like a present. Like we would all run to it. And in just like you would be like you were waiting to talk on the phone. You had to like fight with your sister. It was a big deal. We all got separate phone lines because it was like mayhem in the house, right? Because we wanted to talk to our friends all night. And nowadays, phone calls are a hassle. They're a burden. People swipe to the left and all the time. And then they text, I'll call you later. And it never happens. And it's a really, there's one really fascinating reason for this where I am, even though I put myself on a do not call list, I'd say more than 50% of the phone calls I get, particularly at like 7 o'clock in the morning or 8 o'clock at night, are salespeople. They tell me I want a cruise in Jamaica or they want me to do their, timeshare or, you know, come down to this gambling boat in Louisiana or something like that. And it's almost surreal to me. The it's like junk mail on your phone. So nowadays, you know, we fear the phone ringing.
Mm-hmm. It's upsetting when you think about it because I notice too. I have certain people. There's certain people who, if they call, I will answer pretty much under any circumstances.
Yep.
And then there's other people who I see it ring and I debate on whether I should answer it or not.
But this is the exact distinction I'd like to raise consciousness around. 30 years ago, the sound of the ring was like getting a gift or a present. You wouldn't know who it is. One of the worst things that ever happened to humanity is caller ID. And just your ability to make that decision and, you know, the fact that people are connected all the time. Some people, you know, they put like this special ring. So if it's their son or daughter or something terrible happens, you know, like they keep their phone under their pillow, but they shut it off unless, you know, something terrible happens to one of their kids. Like we're overly connected in some way. And I think that, you know, when you look at why people are so stressed out, it's kind of like those tests on rats in cages. They found that, this is Pavlov and the dogs, but it's intermittent shocks are the most intense way of conditioning someone when like the rat doesn't know that it's going to get a shock or not getting a shock or things like that. It drives rats insane. And we are all those rats because we're walking around with things buzzing on our bodies, you know, for 18 hours a day, maybe 19 or maybe all 24 if you keep your phone under your pillow. And I think it's making us crazy.
Absolutely. Well, I feel crazy half the time with the phone. I am at least I feel like a little more together that I don't keep my phone in the bedroom. But I know a lot of people do. Yeah.
For me, when I go out to restaurants around here and see like really well coiffed, well, like beautiful, beautiful couples sitting there, and instead of gazing into each other's eyes, they're both looking down at their smartphones, and you know, I don't even know what they're doing, but I'm just like, dude, like this is your wife. You married her. Like, put the phone down. Put the device away. Like, this is the time where you connect to your person who you're spending your life with. You know, just put the device away.
Absolutely.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
Well, we are speaking with Ira Israel. He is the author of How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult. And I wanted to ask you, there's a whole list of things that this book will help readers to deal with. And the one that I'm looking at here is Surf the Apparent Paradoxes of Life. And I feel like, I don't know if this is different than it used to be 100 years ago, but I feel like there's a lot more paradoxes than there used to be. So did you want to talk about that for a bit?
Please. So the prefrontal cortex is binary. It functions by categorizing things: black, white, boy, girl, good, bad, good, evil, things like that. And our world is rapidly shifting. You know, the world out there is amorphous. There's a beautiful quote, Shakespeare, when Rosencrantz and Guildenstern approach, he says, "There is nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so." So this is what your brain and your mind do. They chop up the world and they put them into categories that are primarily binary. So for me, you know, I always show in my classes at Esalen and all these places all these optical illusions that I'm sure your listeners know quite well, the rabbit and the duck, or the old woman and the young woman. There's all sorts of optical illusions, and your mind is incapable of holding both images at the same time. So if you can make them flicker very fast if you do something called soft focus. But in general, you know, your mind falls apart. You know, it's like when you have that ability, that your prefrontal cortex to decipher information, when you have that blown out, you know, you go insane. So instead, what I'm advocating is learning how to surf the paradoxes, like things that we consider to be you know, pretty awful today, like say a divorce or something. You know, in 15 years, they're not going to have so much of a charge. And you might look back as your ex-husband or your ex-wife and say, he or she is my greatest teacher. And I use His Holiness the Dalai Lama as an example of that. You know, famously, whenever he's asked, who's your greatest teacher, as the premier spokesperson for Buddhism in the West, you expect His Holiness to say, the Buddha is my greatest teacher. And whenever I've sat with him, someone says, who's your greatest teacher? He says, the Chinese, who killed 2 million of his people. So, you know, we don't have the ability to discern in the instant, you know, the long-term effects of what's going on. We only do it retroactively. And we have to be aware that, you know, for me, a lot of truths are paradoxical. The things that are most important and the things that are most accurate about reality do show up as paradoxes. So we shouldn't be surprised.
So Ira, you teach this stuff, you study this stuff, you write about it. But in your own life, when something happens, like you mentioned, getting 5 lanes of traffic getting cut off with no signal, what do you go through to get yourself back to baseline so you're not shouting obscenities?
There's a couple of things. I have these phrases. One is this the hill you want to die on? That phrase comes up in my head a lot. The other one, particularly when I'm like, when I get a nasty email, I'm thinking of a couple of people in particular when they're trying to exert power over me in some ways, I think, this does not matter. Like this fight does not matter. Just like this, just delete the message. Don't engage. There's no, you know, I was talking to someone this morning and I recounted the story of a great lesson I learned. I was teaching in Portland, Oregon, and I was teaching mindfulness to a group of doctors and PhDs, very, very well educated people. And you can tell when someone in the audience is like not having it, like when the person in the audience, they're kind of like rustling in their seat and they have their arms crossed and they're looking around and they just don't like you. So I remember this gentleman like trying to throw a monkey wrench into my intellectual engine by asking a question. I don't remember what the question was, but it was akin to whenever you go to like a screenwriting class and someone, the teacher's telling you the rules of screenwriting, inevitably somebody raises their hand and says, what about Pulp Fiction? Because Pulp Fiction breaks all the rules, but you have to know the rules to break them. But the kid who says, what about Pulp Fiction? He's just really busting the teacher's chops. So this person, this PhD psychologist, was really just busting my chops. And I knew what he was doing. He was trying to basically say, you're not the smartest guy in the room. I'm the smartest guy in the room. Like, I know more than you. So what I advocate in these instances is you can't fight these things head on. When someone wants to assert something like that, you basically have to make a healthy, rational choice. And so for me, I call it Tai Chiing, because in my understanding of Tai Chi, you're using the own person, the other person's energy, and you're deflecting it off you. You're like letting it go by you. And to me, it's like you're basically just countering that animosity with compassion and love. And you know, in some ways, there was a beautiful, beautiful article this Sunday in the New York Times on Jay-Z, and he recounts the story of how when he goes to bars or something, there could be a guy there who, you know, guys do this macho thing when they're out at night. They're like, "You looking at me? What are you looking at?" You know?
Yeah.
You know? And so he reframes this and he says, you know, these people are suffering and they don't want you to see their suffering. And I thought that was so poetic. That was so Buddhist in a way, to understand that, like, these people are suffering and their only tool is to be the tough guy, because that helped them survive their childhood. They learned how to be the bully, and they don't know any other way. So if you want to help them, you know, be compassionate. If you walk up there and you say, "I'm looking at you," that's going to end in a fight, or that's going to end with somebody dead. And there's no reason for that. So again, for me, it's all about making healthy long-term choices and then realizing your mind's propensities or its reactions, and then saying, "No, I'm going to break this chain of unskillful solutions. I will not pay my suffering forward." And, you know, just taking a couple of breaths, being calm, and not feeding into, you know, any sort of terrible conflict.
I love that. I will not pay my suffering forward.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
The holidays got you down? Whether it's pressure to make it perfect, tension with loved ones, unfulfilled expectations, dissatisfaction at work, or unrest in the world at large, maybe combined with winter weather and darkening days, all of this can contribute to self-judgment and guilt, sadness, and lethargy. It's a tough time of year, and psychotherapist Jeffrey B. Rubin has 7 handy tips and tricks to help you out. 1. Connect with those you love. 2. Have realistic expectations. Seek good enough rather than perfect. 3. Cherish what you're grateful for. 4. Build in what helps you flourish. 5. Create healthy boundaries with loved ones. 6. Constructively address family conflicts through empathetic listening and compassionate feedback. And 7. Help those in need. Good luck out there, and I'm proud of you.
Up next is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Arific on CITR. We are speaking right now with Ira Israel. He is the author of How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult, A Pathway to Authenticity and Awakening. And we ended that last segment with the statement, "I will not pay my suffering forward." I thought that was so beautiful. And it really seems like that's kind of the essence overall of what this book is all about.
Totally. I mean, we were handed a set of tools, a set of solutions, and you know, some of those tools are not the sharpest for getting the job done, and some of those solutions are not the most skillful. And when I say getting the job done, I mean by cultivating loving relationships. So the only thing that correlates strongly with happiness is the quality of your intimate relationships. Nothing else really matters. It's how you connect with other people. And if you have lousy tools for connecting with other people, then you're going to be unhappy. That period. You know, if you insist on being right, if you insist on being the smartest guy in the room, if you insist on being the funniest person, if you insist on anything and don't know how to attune and to connect with other people in a loving, compassionate manner, you're going to end up lonely, alienated, and probably depressed. So the book is trying to treat this by offering people more skillful solutions so that they can break this chain of unskillful solutions that they were handed and have a new set of tools which allows them to have the loving relationships that'll make them happy.
Okay, that sounds really good, and I'm totally on board. And I also have a question, though, because when we're surrounded by people who still want to be the smartest guy or the funniest guy or the whatever in the room and are not skillful, it's challenging. Even if we're being skillful, we can't force other people to play ball with us.
Yeah, no, you can't force them, but you can inspire them. So you have to be the change you want to see in the world. And you have to, you know, like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, you have to be compassionate. And hopefully at some point in time, whether this person is, you know, being negative or sarcastic, whoever's there with you, and you're sitting there just showering them with compassion and you're not feeding in and trying to rise up and, you know, do something that might be momentarily ego gratifying. Hopefully after some amount of time, the person will be like, wow, maybe I'm being a jerk and maybe I need to tweak my own operating system, because, you know, being the sarcastic guy in high school was super, you know, successful. And now that I'm 35 years old, it's just not cutting it anymore.
And Ira, where does self-compassion come into this? Because we all do our best wherever we're at. I'm sure anyone listening to this show is making at least some kind of conscious effort to be more effective and more compassionate, but we're not always successful. So what do we do when we screw up?
Well, I love that thing that Eckhart Tolle calls the voice in the head. So when people come into my office and they're talking about, you know, they suck at this and they're terrible at that and they'll only be happy when they make president and this is wrong and that's wrong, I'll often stop them and say, whose voice is that? And then to raise consciousness more, I'll say, were you born with that voice? Were you born with that voice in the head? So your mind has a negativity bias, and you have more negative thoughts than positive ones, and it does that to protect you. But, you know, there are certain situations where you need to accept your life and accept the fact that you're going to screw up sometime, and not, you know, it doesn't make the situation any better by berating yourself. So it's not self-compassion so much as it is as just acceptance. This is reality. You know, look at baseball players. They you know, like the best only hit the ball 1 out of 3 times. You know, that's the best. So, like, you know, be compassionate with yourself. Nobody bats 1,000. Nobody even bats 500. You know, like the best baseball players only bat 300. So, like, it's the same with us. You know, just show up in a loving manner and know that you're going to screw up once in a while.
All right. Thank you. So we're speaking with Ira Israel. He's the author of How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult, A Pathway to Authenticity and Awakening. And I love how you pointed out it's a pathway, not the pathway. If I had written this book, I probably would have said it's the pathway, because my way is the best way. Because that's what we all like to think, right? But I'm wondering, as we're getting closer to closing the show, I'm wondering what you'd like to focus on for the last few minutes.
Well, I think that one of the key tools that we're learning in our society is acceptance and grief and forgiveness. Like, those things, particularly as a man in this culture, are really, really difficult to embody, to incarnate, to take time to cry if you have to, or to you know, forgive someone, be vulnerable. We have this definition of these gender roles, and I'm happy that they're collapsing around us. You know, there's been terrible things with these gender roles. There's been horrifying sexual harassment. There's been, you know, all sorts of tragedies and terrible things. So unfortunately, we're living in this exceptionally confusing time where, you know, things are not binary, things are non-binary, and they're amorphous, and they're all the rules and regulations of gender roles are kind of like out the window right now. So we have to really just be as loving and compassionate as possible, you know, with ourselves and with all people around us, because, you know, even though we live in a very privileged society, you know, all of us have situations that are painful that we have to learn how to surf through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that this whole thing has brought up a lot for the whole Me Too on social media has brought up a lot for me. And I'm seeing both sides of it. I'm seeing the victims of this. And then I'm seeing all the people who are afraid because accusations are being thrown out from, you know, 25, 30 years ago. And the person now is maybe not the same person that they were back then. Mm-hmm. It's a scary time for a lot of people, and there's the promise of this greater world, and yet we're kind of in the mud,
right,
slogging through trying to get there.
Well, there's a tectonic shift going on right now, and you know, those people who came out on the Me Too campaign are the bravest people in the world. So we really have to listen to their voices and to whatever they have been holding on to for the past, you know, 1 year or 25 years or 30 years. It doesn't matter. And, you know, we really have to create a space and a dialogue so that we, you know, can move forward and be respectful and be loving and interact with each other, whether we're men, women, transgender, in a more kind way.
Thank you. And coming up to the holidays, do you have any, just one tip for us to get through?
It's the easiest one in the world. As I said, Ram Dass's famous quote, whenever you think you're enlightened, go spend the weekend with your family. So whenever you hear that voice in your head that says, and again, this is about cultivating non-reactivity. Normally when a family member says something, I had this thing happen in the office the other day. It was so fascinating. Can I swear on your show, by the way, or no?
I can bleep it out. Sure.
Okay. Bleep it out. So a guy turns to his partner and he's like, honey, look, the Christmas tree. Did you see the Christmas tree? It doesn't look fantastic. And she was washing the dishes and she just like totally erupted. She was like, can't you see I'm washing the dishes? I haven't looked at the Christmas tree, right? And it was a totally disproportionate response. And so for me, what I advocate with people who are going home for the holidays is just always take a deep breath. And for in that breath, just measure your response. Because when you're triggered, you know, you become dysregulated. And when you can't regulate your emotions, you blow up. And it only exacerbates the situation. It only makes the situation worse. So again, look at the solution that your body or your mind is telling you and say, wow, is that going to help this conversation end in a loving, peaceful manner? Or is it going to end up with people slamming doors and throwing plates?
Hmm. And there's another, when my boyfriend overreacts to me, if I'm able to catch myself before I react in response, I'll take a second, like, this is not the way, you know, what I would expect. And then I'll ask, are you hungry? And then he'll stop
great.
And think, and he realizes that's probably why I'm so upset. Yeah.
There's a beautiful quote that I have. That is akin to what the Jay-Z reframing is. And to raise consciousness, if I'm with a friend or and she's getting dysregulated, I'll say something like, why are you pointing your suffering at me? You know, this is like if I can realize, like, this isn't about me, this is about something else. And, you know, it's not life threatening that I didn't, wash the dish rags or not fill up the car or left the toilet seat up. Like, what is this really about? And, you know, if I see somebody hurting or suffering, I'll say, Like, are you really sure you want to point your suffering at me right now?
I appreciate that. Thank you, Ira. Well, it's just about time to close up the show. We've been speaking with Ira Israel. He's the author of How to Survive Your Childhood Now That You're an Adult. And you can find him at his website, iraisrael.com. And is there anything you'd like to add before we close the show?
I do these retreats at the Esalen Institute, and they're so magical. I would just convey anyone to go to my website, iraisrael.com, and go into the classes part. And really, it's a very interesting phenomenon because, you know, you think you go to some of these places to learn a little of yoga or mindfulness, but the thing that really happens there is magical, and you can't advertise it, because when people create a safe space, an authentic space with no cell phones and just no judgment, there's a lot of emotional processing that takes place and a lot of really strong bonds and connections. So one of the most moving and important parts of my life is getting a group of 40, 50 people together. We don't know each other on Sunday, and normally by the middle of the week, we're best friends, and there's a lot of camaraderie and hugging and support. And it's a really wonderful juxtaposition to the competitive nature of our interactions in daily life, you know, when we're at work in society. So the only thing I would advocate for people is, you know, like, find a way to, you know, put your cell phone, put the device away, take a week off, you know, go someplace where you can submerge yourself in water and take hikes and commune with other fellow human beings.
Yeah. Look each other in the eyes.
Yeah.
It's not as scary as when you see someone on the street like I did today. Oh, I miss the days when we would just talk to people.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully we're on our way back there now. So thank you so much for the work that you're doing, Ira. Again, iraisrael.com is where you can find more information. Thanks so much for your time, Ira.
Thank you, Maria. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure as well. And thank you for listening. I want to send you lots of love. Be well. Have a great week. Namaste.
Slow down. You're not in a race. Alcohol-related deaths are one of the leading preventable causes of death in Canada. Please remember to drink responsibly.
Tired of begging for rides from your friends?
Bobby, I don't have time to take you to the soda shop again this week.
Lugging those groceries on the bus got you in a sweat?
Man, oh man, these bags of salt sure are hefty.
Being on campus without a car ain't easy, so check out Zipcar and get wheels when you want them. Join now to get your membership for only $20 at zipcar.ca/UBC.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
Hello, hello, hello. This is Russian Tim, and I'm throwing a Christmas Rager on December 15th at the Cobalt. I invited to play the show some of my favorites, The Greatest Sons, The Core, Anthems, Contracode, and even my band, Russian Tim and Pavel Vorez. Tickets at the door are $15, but $10 online at myshowpass.com. Christmas Rager, December 15th, Cobalt, great success.
Mikey, I just know we're gonna find you and bring you home. I Crimes and Treasons Radio. This is Riff Raff. Every Tuesday from 9 to 11 p.m. on 101.9 FM.
Yes, yes, you and I rocking with the best. 101.9 CITR Radio. Crimes and Treasons, this is your boy Just Blaze. Right now you're rocking with Jules Andre Brown, Rolly Rails, Jamal Steels, and Horsepower. You know what it is, right?
Yo, it's Iron Sue, man. I want to shout out Crimes and Treasons Radio, man. CITR 101.9, man. Turn up, turn up, turn up, turn up.